Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition. Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
For more in-depth perspectives and interesting stories, sign up for our daily newsletter at tvo.org/daily.
Few things inspire learning the way natural wonder does. Awe, enthusiasm, and terrific insight help too. Latif Nasser, dare I say it, Mississauga's own Latif Nasser, brings all of that to his new science docuseries on Netflix. It's called Connected, and it shows how connected we are in ways you'd never expect. Latif is director of research for the New York Public Radio show Radio Lab, and he joins us now from Los Angeles, California for more. Hello there, my fellow Canadian. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me.
Not at all. It's a pleasure. I just want to, before we get too far into this conversation, show folks a little bit of what you've been up to, because it is absolutely spectacular. So stand by, and Sheldon, roll it, please.
My name is Latif Nasser. I'm a science reporter.
Oh, wow.
And this is a show about the astonishing connections all around us. Connections between you, me, and our world, that'll make you see that world in a whole new way.
Very important question. Does the Queen's poop come through here?
It has a flag on it, so we salute as she comes. Okay.
How is the cloud above your head connected to the cloud that stores your data? How can an obscure mathematical law help make sense of your favorite song?
Benford's law.
Could you Benford Beyonce?
If anything does work, then it probably
is Beyonce.
And let's go to Twitter now, where you introduced your program by saying, "My Netflix show just went live." If I had to sum it up, it's basically if Bill Nye and Anthony Bourdain had an awkward Muslim baby. But it's more than that. Now, that's very funny, but for the uninitiated, would you care to elaborate on that tweet?
Sure. It's basically a science show where I go all over the world looking for the surprising, often beautiful and poetic connections between us and each other and us and the world around us.
Well, I should follow up on something that you said there in that trailer, which is essentially the obscure mathematical Benford's law and Beyonce, the connection there. I must confess, I didn't get it yet, but so maybe you could help me out.
Well, let me first explain what Benford's law is.
Good idea.
Make it easier. So Benford's law is this kind of astonishing natural pattern that you can find in almost every giant data set of numbers. So just take any seemingly random batch of numbers like stock market prices or, your tax returns or something. If you take all of those numbers and then you strip just the first digit, you're only looking at the first number of those numbers, the first digit. Now you'd think that every number out of 1 through 9, they would appear 1/9 of the time, right? It's a random data set effectively. But what you find is actually that's not the case at all. Out of that random batch of numbers, about 30% of them will start with a 1. And then it'll get less and less and less frequent. So 2 is less frequent, 3 is less frequent, 4 less frequent, until you get to 9, which is only about, it's less than 5% of the time, which is just so strange that random numbers would follow this. It makes a really pretty curve. And so alone, that feels like, okay, maybe that's just a kind of a weird factoid, a surprising factoid. But then to me, the astonishing thing was you could see all these different realms of our world where this applies and is actually quite helpful. It's helpful to catch tax cheats. It's helpful to find Twitter bots. It's helpful to sniff out election malfeasance. And the way that it connects to Beyonce is we found a paper where scientist applied it to the durations of notes. So if you take a song or a discography of a certain artist, like I think they use something like Beethoven, and they use more classical music. But If you add the durations of the individual notes, it follows this same pattern. It's this pattern that sort of is in all of these places where nobody expected it to be and where nobody was sort of purposefully putting it.
Thus the connection. Let me ask you another one of these seemingly random points, but you bring it up in your series as well. Dust from the Sahara Desert fertilizes Amazon rainforests in South America. How does that happen?
So it's an incredible thing. Basically, there's this one spot in the Sahara Desert, which used to be, it's a kind of a dried up lake bed from 1,000 years ago. And basically, there are kind of mountains nearby placed in such a way that it creates this wind tunnel effect, and it kicks up all this dust way high into the atmosphere, which then, exactly as you can see there, it carries it fully over the Atlantic Ocean. Some of it winds up on the Gulf Coast of North America. Some of it actually crosses Mexico or Central America into the Pacific Ocean, and some of it lands it kind of sprinkles itself down over the Amazon rainforest and provides kind of replenishment of much needed nutrients that the Amazon rainforest needs to kind of keep going.
Amazing. How challenging is it for you? Because you are dealing in, you know, sometimes very complicated scientific theories and so on. How difficult is it to sort of break that down for an audience that may not know anything about science? You know, you've opened the door to it for us because of your enthusiasm and so on. But how hard is that to do?
Well, it is tricky. I mean, you need to, in a way, I think it's almost the harder thing is to make it make sense to myself. Once it makes sense to me, it's much easier for me to explain it to everybody else. So part of it is figuring out how to make it make sense to me. But then also another part of it is sort of, I've found in my career, leading with the question is so much more powerful, so much more helpful than kind of trying to just explain it as an answer, as just to say, here's a factoid that that I'm just going to present to you sort of fully formed. If instead you ask it as a question, this dust is being kicked up, where is it going? Let's follow it. And how do we know where it's going? So once you start to see, you know, oh, well, scientists have seen it over here and scientists have seen it over here, but how could it go from there to there? All of a sudden, I think people have a higher threshold of complexity than most TV gives them credit for. I think your show is a testament to that. But also, if you lead with the question, people will follow you to even if they're a few kind of complicated speed bumps along the way, people will follow you to get to that answer.
You've obviously been all over the world and seen some pretty amazing things, but I really need to know what the craziest thing that's happened to you was in the course of making this show.
Well, speaking of the dust, one of the things we did was in order to kind of see how that dust actually falls down over the Amazon rainforest, we went to this place called the Amazon Tall Tower Observatory, which is basically like a giant skyscraper in the middle of the Amazon rainforest where there are no other buildings. It's basically the size of the Eiffel Tower. And the day I went there, of course, the elevator was broken, so we had to take the stairs. And so we went with the stairs all the way up. We had this expert with us, a meteorologist. We finally get up to the top. I mean, and it took maybe an hour and a half to just climb the stairs. All the camera ops had the gear and, you know, so like we were all drenched in sweat. We just get to the top. I start to do my interview with the expert at the top, and it couldn't have been a minute, maybe 2 minutes. He looked out. He's a meteorologist. And he said, oh, that's a storm cloud. Like there's a thunderstorm coming. We're basically on an enormous lightning rod. If we stay here in 10 or so minutes, we're going to be electrocuted. We got to go. And so we did maybe a minute and a half or so of the rest of the interview. And then we just beelined down, kind of jumping down these stairs. It took us probably about an hour and a half, as I said, to get up there. It probably took us about 10 minutes to get down.
And did in fact the storm come, and did in fact the tower get hit?
It actually, as a testament to how complicated meteorology is, even this prediction, this 10 minutes out prediction from the height of the clouds, the cloud passed by the tower, and we would have been fine.
Wow. I want to take you back. You grew up, as we pointed out off the top, in the province of Ontario. And at what point did it sort of, was there a eureka moment where you decided, I need to be a science journalist?
There wasn't a eureka moment about science, but there was kind of a, I feel like I was primed to become a reporter. I have one sister, she's also a journalist. And both of us, the thing we credit to our kind of love of asking questions of kind of keeping up with the world around us is that our dad would do this kind of amazing thing, which is that every morning, our dad is a very, very early riser. He would wake up really early and go to the mosque every morning and try to drag us along. But we were kids who, like, you know, couldn't be bothered to wake up that early. But the thing he would do is after the mosque, he would read the entire Toronto Star. And we'd still be sleeping. This is my memory of being woken up like every morning of my childhood. He would burst into my room, like almost like Kramer style from Seinfeld. And he would tell us the stories of the day. He would just like start, he would just go and he would tell us. And it didn't matter that I didn't understand half of what he was talking about. I mean, I would pick up on the fly and, you know, I'd be like the only middle school kid who could tell you all about the Briex gold mining scandal or something, you know. It was an amazing thing. It was a kind of the kind of education that I think most kids don't get, and the kind of education that inspired us to say, hey, there's exciting stuff going on out there. I want to know all about it.
Latif, I love the way that you say, you know, I have one sister who happens to be a journalist as well, because, let me just think here. Yeah, 2 years ago, you may recognize this person. The one on the left is me, and the one on the right co-hosted the Ontario Election Leaders Debate with me. And I'm pretty sure you know her, don't you?
That's my sister, Farah Nasser from Global News.
Okay, so I want to know how much smack you two talk to each other about who the better journalist is.
Oh, well, the funny thing is that, I feel like until now I had ceded TV to her and I was the radio guy and she was the TV person. And now I'm kind of encroaching on her zone. But she's taking to it very nicely. But yeah, I think we're a little bit territorial, I think, a little bit competitive. But yeah, I don't know. Maybe she's going to expand into radio. Then I don't know what's going to happen.
Well, in terms of territorial, what? You give her Canada and you insist on the rest of the world? Yeah. Is that how it works?
That's maybe it, too. But she's there's more than enough in Ontario to keep her busy.
No kidding. Well, I have to say, it was a great experience co-hosting that debate with her. She was absolutely terrific. Okay, let's move on here. You've got a PhD in the history of science from Harvard. Do I have that right?
That is correct.
Okay, how has that helped shape the reporting that you do? Because this just in, I bet you there are not too many reporters that have got a PhD in anything from anywhere. So that makes you a little bit distinctive.
Yeah, I think to me the fun about this particular field, which a lot of people don't even know exists, the history of science, it's taking the big, ambitious, kind of almost existential questions often of science and life and death stakes, pressing questions of science, and finding a way to historicize them, to kind of turn them into stories about people who are trying to answer those questions, people who are sort of, you know, trying their best, who are coming up with experiments, trying, you know, let's say public health measures or whatever else. It's a way to take science, which can often be cold and feel lifeless and very sterile, and finding the human beating heart behind it. And so I feel like that's the thing I studied, and now that's very much the thing that I do. I try to tell those stories in such a way that they feel human. They don't feel like they are just some sterile paper, some stack of facts that, you know, you couldn't care less about, because so often they're not.
Well, you may have answered the question, but let me follow up anyway here. What would you say is the single most important thing that you, as a science journalist, need to remember as you're trying to convey facts to what is certainly not going to be, a science-based audience? What do you need to remember?
I think there's it's a tightrope you have to walk where you can't be too breathless and just, you know, swallow everything and not ask any critical questions and just say, oh, science knows everything, you know, because it doesn't. You need a healthy skepticism. That's baked into the very fundamental premise of science. At the same time, you can't just shrug your shoulders and say, oh, you know, nothing matters. There's nothing is knowable. All these scientists are shills and are, you know, corrupted by this or that or the other thing, or this thing is just unknowable. Cause it's not, you know, we really do know things. It really will save lives to wear masks. But how do you kind of keep that healthy skepticism while also kind of say, you know what, this is the best we have to go on. This is what we all need to do. Walking that tightrope is a tricky thing. And it's, you know, I think what I try to do is sort of present both these cases to the viewers and let them, with their hopefully good judgment, parse and decide for themselves.
Latif, who was detainee 244 at Guantanamo Bay Prison?
Yeah, this I was shocked to find that there was a detainee at Guantanamo Bay. And I found kind of totally serendipitously, I mean, I guess if that's the right word, on Twitter, that there was a guy at Guantanamo Bay with my exact name. I'm Latif Nasser. His name is Abdul Latif Nasser, which was a name I also went by when I was in when I did a foreign exchange in Morocco, which is where he was from. Anyway, I found this guy who I just all of a sudden needed to know so much more about him. There was almost no reporting about him. And I started digging. I found this kind of a WikiLeaked rap sheet from the Department of Defense, from the U.S. Department of Defense, about what he did, saying basically that he was Al-Qaeda's top explosives expert, a very important military aide to Osama bin Laden. And then I found his lawyer. I talked to his lawyer, who told me, no, he was never in Al-Qaeda. Didn't know bin Laden, wrong place, wrong time, had nothing to do with any of that. And the United States government in Guantanamo Bay has kept him a prisoner for almost now going on 20 years without trial, without charges. And in fact, on the opposite side, having unanimously cleared him for release back to Morocco, but he's just sort of sitting there without ever having any kind of due process, 20 years later. So I found out about this guy, these two kind of as polar opposite as you could possibly get portraits of him, and I needed to find out more. And so that was sort of the jumping off point for a six-part miniseries I did for New York Public Radio.
That was a podcast series, yes?
That's right, yeah. And called The Other Latif.
The Other Latif. And are you satisfied that in your own mind you actually got to the bottom of his story?
I did and I didn't. I mean, I wasn't, because he's at Guantanamo, which is this sort of black hole. The way I talked about him is this man was kind of a black hole in a black hole. I wasn't able to access him, to talk to him, to interview him. And so many of the other sources that I had, whether they be former Guantanamo detainees who had been tortured about their stories, whether it had been, former like intelligence agents, spy type folks, or government, bureaucrats in the United States who were very loath to talk about this, you know, blight on American foreign policy. Nobody would talk to me. So we were basically, I was dealing with crumbs, like evidentiary scraps, and trying to knit them together as best I could. I'm sure I got things wrong because it's just, there was so little evidence to go on. I think and hope one day more of this evidence will come out. If not, Abdul Latif Nasser himself will be released, and I can get more of that story and correct maybe the extrapolations I sort of necessarily needed to make to do a story about this guy.
Yeah, I mean, I presume you'd love to meet him someday and just have a chat with him.
Yeah, and ask him sort of. Ask him all the questions. I worked for 3 years on this series, and I had so many questions. Why did he make this turn? Why did he make that turn? So much of the evidence against him was seemed to have been sort of made up or grossly exaggerated. While on the other hand, there was some that I found quite solid basis for. I joked that the closest thing he ever had to a trial was right here in my garage studio, because he never got one any other place. I'd love to like sit down and talk with him and ask him what actually happened. What's your life story? How did you wind up at Guantanamo?
I want to ask you about curiosity over authority. And to that end, you said something once upon a time, which was you'd much rather be the so-called dumbest guy in the room than the smartest guy, because that's more intellectually honest. What do you mean by that?
Well, I do the same thing as you do, which is that we ask questions for a living, and we do that on purpose because we don't think we have all the answers. There are people out there who devote their lives to trying to understand some of the biggest mysteries of our world, of our societies, that often they're not just sort of these academic abstract mysteries. They're these mysteries that really have, major stakes in some cases, like as we can see with COVID, life and death stakes. I don't want to be the guy who comes in and pretends to know everything or even something, because I think that on the one hand, as a proxy for the viewer, I think I'm just the ambassador for the person who's sort of half-heartedly watching while they're cooking their dinner or whatever. So I have to be that person. But on the other hand, I think it's just genuinely true. I mean, so often in my studies, in my reporting, things I thought I knew so deeply and that were so rock solid turned out not to be. And so for me, I think that the best place to approach this job of conveying, important information, of asking people really big questions, is to come in kind of and check your assumptions at the door and to genuinely ask the question, not just pretend to ask the question so that I look smart, but to actually genuinely ask the question, which is something that I actually value your work as well.
I was just going to say that's what I try to do every day of my life. And so I'm with you on that one. Or as the kids say today, I feel you on that one, Latif. We're down to our last minute here, and I want to just ask you finally about the irony of the title of your series, which is Connected, which is, of course, something that the world is really not supposed to be doing right now. We're supposed to be physically distanced from one another in order to beat this pandemic. How do we stay connected while at the same time fight this damn pandemic?
Well, one kind of irony, I think, from the show is that even if you don't think you are connected, even if we are sort of staying in our homes, even if we are, sort of sealed off in our respective countries, the air we breathe, the selfies we post, the poop we poop, these things, they actually connect us in deep ways that we kind of, I think, so often take for granted. I mean, there is definitely something to be said for, call up your relatives who you haven't talked to in a while, check in on people because you don't know what they're going through. But even beyond that, we are all connected in these deep, deep ways that we just barely have an inkling about.
Well, I have to say, it's a delight to meet the other journalist in the Nasser family, having already met the first journalist in the family. But you gave yourself the title of ambassador, and I kind of like that. So let me thank Ambassador Latif Nasser for coming on to TVO tonight. And we are happy to recommend Connected on Netflix for everybody. Season 2 in the works, incidentally?
If they let me. I mean, I got a lot of ideas, but we'll see what happens. Netflix,
they got lots of money, buddy. Go after them. They got lots of money. You go get them. It's been a real pleasure to meet you. Lots of luck going forward.
The Agenda with Steve Paikin is brought to you by the Chartered Professional Accountants of Ontario. CPA Ontario is a regulator, an educator, a thought leader, and an advocate. We protect the public. We advance our profession. We guide our CPAs. We are CPA Ontario. And by viewers like you. Thank you.